Welcome everybody to the Longhorn Republic, your source for Texas Longhorn news, sports, and opinions with a bit of snark built in. If you like what we do, please leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Helps get the show out there. Share this with your friends where you found it, whether it was Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, anywhere where you find fine podcast content. You can find Kyle and myself. Connect with us on social media at Longhorn Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, the Longhorn Republic, or shoot us an email, longhornrepublicpod@gmail.com. My name is Gerald Goodridge. I'm your host this week, like I am every week. And I'm joined by a man who's as flexible with his scheduling as some sort of scheduling Gumby, Kyle Carpenter. Kyle, how are you?
Is the joke that we're recording on Wednesday or that the SEC schedule came out? Because I have content loaded either way.
The SEC schedule isn't really that flexible. So let's go with that. We're recording on Wednesday because this week has been weird.
Yeah. Gerald, we are recording for the first time with you back, with both of us in the state of Texas. This is pretty exciting. You left the city so nice they named it twice, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and made your way back to the great state, but had a brief detour out of the state. And I also had a work event last night, and there was a baseball game going on Monday, and I have a dog who's sitting next to me and like underneath my leg because he's so medicined up, a 15-year-old who's going to live another 15 years. We're sure of it. With modern science and medicine. So here we are. We're recording on Wednesday night. But it worked out because we get to talk about some things that happened Wednesday.
I had a weird travel day for work on Sunday, Monday night. The baseball game was happening, and I was deliriously tired because of that weird travel day, and we had other things going on. So it's Wednesday. We know we promised you two shows this week, but scheduling things happen. We are all adults. We'll get over it. So starting next week, we actually already have the content locked and loaded. We will have two shows for you, two very full interview shows for you next week as well. There was a national championship that was crowned this last week, so we'll give you our thoughts on the track team, the ladies track team, and their incredible year. We'll talk about that baseball game because we have to. The good, the bad, the ugly of it. Down the 40, burnt orange lenses, and everything in between. So, as was expected and predicted, number one women's track wins the national championship. It is the fifth outdoor title in program history with the highest total points scored, 83, which is the most in Texas history, led by none other than the woman, the myth, the legend herself, Julian Alfred, scoring more than 25% of Texas's total points with her wins in the 100 and 200, as well as her part of the 4x1 relay team, making her the fifth in history to get the 1, the 2, and the 4x1 triple crown. If anybody else wins the Bowerman this year, we should burn it down. Like the trophy, the people that give it, their homes, the place where it's housed in the off season, everything. Grab the pitchforks and the torches, burn it down.
Look, her biggest competition is two of her teammates who both won national championships. We'll talk about it a little bit, but yeah, I mean, you're seeing someone who's special. You're seeing someone who, you know, unfortunately for the Olympics next summer is not an American, but is just going to go win gold immediately after graduating college. Is just going to step in and be, you know, continue to be the fastest woman on the planet. She's rarely do you see someone who's so good live up to every single, no stumbles, no falters, you know, never was behind in 100 meter the entire indoor and outdoor season. Won every race, just unblemished, untouchable, you know, set records all around with other great teammates in the 4x1. But again, the 100, you're looking at the two sprinters races. You're really your best of sprinters run the 200, the second shortest race. And just to sweep all three of those with relative ease, it's really something. I mean, her biggest competition for the Bowerman struggled a bit. Arkansas standout who lost to Rosita Adeleke in the 400. So I think it's a no-brainer. I think Julian Alfred will win it hands down. I think the conversation, again, shifts to her place in the pantheon of all-time great Texas Longhorns, not just track, where I think she's on that Mount Rushmore, if you remember our series from a couple summers ago.
Gotta be.
But generally, I mean, someone who's just that good, that dominant, no stumbles whatsoever, just didn't lose a race that she entered this year. And a lot of them not close. She was running against her own ghost and, you know, trying to break her own records.
Yeah, holds the St. Lucian record for both the 100 and 200 in spite of never running for them in the Olympics. So we'll see her obviously make it there this upcoming year. But St. Lucia going to get some gold medals out of the deal. Can't be too mad about that. I mean, obviously, we would love to have her running for the U.S., but it is what it is. The 4x1 relay team, which she was a part of, completed its historic season and defended its title from last year. Alfred, Azina Abba, Adeleke that Kyle mentioned, and Kavana Davis broke the collegiate record not one, not two, but three times this season, with the most recent during the semifinals of the NCAA tournament. The aforementioned Davis actually also earned a bronze in the 200 with a season best time of 22.02. There was a absolutely just incredible 400 run from Adeleke, 49.2, second fastest time in NCAA history. Like, the sheer dominance of this group was just astronomical. Christine Blazevica, third in the heptathlon. Akelia Smith winning the long jump. Like, this was a wire-to-wire, just dominant performance like we've never really seen from Texas track. And I think Coach Flo is not the right word, but Coach Flo is really hitting his stride. And I think if the men can pick up their end of the bargain, Texas is going to be the it school for track for years and years to come.
Flo is getting his flowers. He's starting to get the recognition he deserves on a national stage. I think folks are saying, look, Del Conte knows how to go out and scoop a coach from another program, but Floreal is the template for that, right? Taking him from Kentucky, who Kentucky was a power while he was there. They're not, as you saw this year, quite anywhere near the level after he left, but they went in and just brought him over, and you know, they won indoor, won outdoor. They were dominant. That Adeleke run, by the way, again against a Arkansas's 400 runner was, you know, I don't know, favored, but it was a neck and neck. It was one everyone had circled. She beat her on the home stretch so badly that the woman who was expected to then go and win the hurdles got seventh in the 400 hurdles because she looked like she put everything on the line trying to catch Adeleke earlier, you know, in an earlier race and just didn't have anything left. So really broke Arkansas's spirit doubly there, but you have to give it. I think Akelia Smith may have had the most drama out of the whole thing. She fouled her first two attempts in the long jump, used her final jump to become the second Longhorn ever to be a long jump national championship after, of course, Tara Davis recently, I think 21. She was the runner-up in the triple jump with a personal best, which I think gives her the top eight in Texas history there. So the jumps are always something Flo is going to prioritize, and he's known as maybe the best in the world at coaching long jump and especially women's long jump and triple jump. His men pretty good too, but you know, having this level of sprinters as well is tough to beat because you know Texas has it in the field. And they obviously blazed across the track at home as well.
In front of the home crowd on the men's side, the men finished 13, led by the Nuge, Leo Nugenbauer, winning the decathlon, breaking the NCAA record and a nearly 40-year-old German record with a score of 8,836 points. Also the eighth highest point total in world history, which essentially, again, we talked about a gold medal on the ladies' side, but like, the Nuge is setting himself up for a gold medal run in the Olympics next year, and it's going to be absolutely incredible to watch.
Yeah, it was cool to see. He set personal best in 7 out of the 10 events of the decathlon. Like, dude was ready on his home turf to secure the bag. This was the other, literally, race that U.S. track fans had circled. It was the 400 plus the decathlon with Nuge versus a really standout decathlete from the University of Georgia, who both will be in the Olympics for sure next summer. But he was not expected to win this. He kind of was the surprise in the fact that he had the seven personal bests. Discus was like a millimeter away from breaking the all-time collegiate decathlon discus record. So again, Texas does well in the throws. We thought it was just a Krauser-Papiri phenomenon, but seems to be well-coached on the field side at throwing objects far. But the Nuge, man, what a dude. Loved having him on the 40 acres. Again, we'll be rooting only for Longhorns who aren't Americans at next summer's Olympics, but he'll be representing Germany and, again, probably bringing home a gold.
Yeah, it's one of those weird things where, like, you know, the Olympics is this exercise and like cheering for your country, but so much of the University of Texas contingent that's going to be there is not going to be competing for the U.S. Thankfully, the swimming and diving team is usually almost exclusively U.S. athletes.
We have some Dutch swimmers as well.
A couple of them, yeah. The flying, the floating Dutchman. it's going to be, I mean, the Olympics are always fun regardless, and I'm excited to get to watch so many Longhorn. I'm excited to see if we can. How many countries Texas is going to be bigger than in the Olympics next year? It's going to be really fun. That's always my favorite activity for the Summer Olympics.
So I don't want to leave out Yusuf Bizimana was the runner-up, the silver medalist in the 800, now holds two of the top five in school history, and just a couple others who scored points. Give them their credit, Creighton Carosa in the 800 as well. Jeremiah Nubby, who's, again, a freshman in that discus we talked about, so there's some people continuing on the throwing legacy there, and Sam Hurley in the high jump, all finished as second team All-Americans and all scored.
Again, a great year from the ladies. The men, I think, are in a little bit of a rebuilding year in some ways, but they'll be back. They'll be back in competing for natties sooner rather than later. Another team that's going to be back, Texas, falls on the road to number 8 Stanford. Rallied, came from behind in game one for a 7-5 victory, and then games 2 and 3, they fell in game 2, 8-3. Game 3 was on the list of things that have happened that are heartbreaking in the University of Texas sports history. This has got to be at least top 5. You know, I say that, but it also might not be top 1 this year, right? The the rowing team hitting a gaggle of geese is one of those, like, which one is more infuriating for Texas fans? Both of them ended up having major bearings on the Director's Cup finale. But either way, Texas fell 7-6 on some of the most frustrating, we're just going to go and say it, one of the most frustrating strike zones I think either team has seen in about a decade. But again, it's a mar on what honestly should be a celebrated season. I know the standard for Texas is Omaha, but coming within one game of Omaha in a year where they were picked to finish 4th in the conference and not even potentially make the NCAA tournament, this was supposed to be a rebuilding year, and Texas was a weird strike zone and some weird lights in Palo Alto away from going back to Omaha. So I think we have to, like, yes, it's disappointing to lose that way, but there's a massive grain of salt that you have to take when you talk about the way that the season ended compared to the season overall.
Yeah, there was a point when we thought 4th was generous the way we started the season. There was a, don't forget, a 16-game winning streak that really changed everything. And then Texas got a little, I don't know if you want to call it complacent, but there was that OU getting swept at home. Like, this season had some lows. But a team of fighters, again, we talked about it, a young team with Jared Thomas and Flores both being, you know, true freshmen who stepped right in and were, you know, major contributors. We'll see exactly who comes back on this team. We know, you know, some players who won't be in the outfield will lose a lot. Like, there's, you know, Eric Kennedy had a fantastic game 3 to his credit, and we'll, unless he finds another loophole to do, you know, a Austin Todd 10th year will be his last. But you know, losing him in center field will certainly be a blow. Dylan Campbell, I think, his skyrocketed up draft boards this season, and really in the second half of the season from where he may have originally been slated, he has shown to be a 5-tool player, and had this, you know, sequence where he hit the RBI to tie it in game 3, and then, you know, had the throughout Stanford's fastest player twice, honestly, in the 8th to, you know, what should have been send the game into extras. You know, some weird lighting happened, and man, he was in tears after the game, and it was brutal seeing him take it so personally, because it was a fly that was kind of, you know, beyond second base and right field, right center. No one saw it, and it was interesting to see the national discourse immediately turn to, yeah, this happened to this team, this happened to this team, this happened to the Aggies, this has happened in years past, last year's region, like, you know, the Twitter, who usually will come together to hate on the Longhorns, seem to come immediately to hate on the sunken diamond, which, you know, the apparently the people who know more than me, the lights point straight down. And so if you're not familiar with it in that twilight at that exact time for about 15 to 30 minutes, it's impossible. You can't see a ball. And Lucas Gordon came in like a fighter. He didn't have his best stuff Friday. He had great stuff, almost gave up a home run, but then fought back, struck out a guy with six consecutive strikes, I think, in that inning, had two outs, you know, got a guy to pop up, was getting them to extras. He was ready to go for, you know, however many innings it took. They were there. They were poised. They fought twice back from three-run deficits in that Sunday game, and it really was a heartbreaking way because it was a tremendous game, even though, as Gerald alluded to, the strike zone for both teams, I think, was frustrating because it was consistently inconsistent, like for both teams and between innings and when there was two strikes and if it was a left-handed batter or a right-handed batter, it just – you didn't know exactly what that dude was calling. You know, there was a Texas player who got – hit, but they called it a foul ball. There was a Texas guy who probably made the tag. It was pretty close, but didn't get that call. There really were no bang-bang plays that went Texas's favor. Stanford, you know, scored three runs in the third, I believe, after a strikeout that would have ended that inning that wasn't called. So, you know, it went both ways. There were some calls that Stanford fans weren't happy with. I thought Texas got a little bit less favorable umpiring, but there was a Stanford color commentator. Also don't think alums should be able to call their own team's games in super regionals. Don't put Swindell in there, even though he's, you know, the Texas folks are the best in the biz, but just don't do it. You know, put a truly neutral party out there. But anyways, that's all aside to say, Gerald, you're right. A great super regional if they pull out game 1 and 3 and move on to Omaha. What a story. You have to play Wake Forest, who looks as unbeatable as any team in the country right now. So good luck, Stanford. But they could have gotten there and a year when, again, to take it all the way back. After the first weekend, 2 weeks of this season, we thought, are we firing Coach Pierce? Are we blowing this thing up completely and starting it over? And you just saw a tremendous coaching job where the players fought for him, where he made things happen. And this might be his best coaching job of his career in getting them this far.
There were folks that were ready to fire him after the OU series. And I think we have to really like take it in stride and look at, again, where Texas started this year, where they ended the year. And again, they were one weird one away from going to Omaha. And I think, yes, there are no such thing as moral victories, especially when it comes to Texas baseball. But this was a team that had very low expectations for what is normally expected from Texas, right? A fourth place finish in conference is low expectations for Texas. They're expected to be competing for the conference year in and year out. And so the fact that Texas won the regular season title and had the second best finish in the NCAA tournament, all the conference, them and TCU, right? Like, it is absolutely incredible to think about the ceiling for this team next year, because all this young talent is just going to get better. Yes, they're going to need to replace some of the key players, but I think David Pierce has this thing moving. And I think the most promising thing, and you and I ragged on it quite a bit, so I'm going to have to call it out, is I think we saw the pitching develop this year. It was inconsistent in some spots, and I think that's just part of having collegiate players pitching baseballs. But LeBaron Johnson, where did that come from, right? The bullpen got better. It wasn't perfect, but it got better. I mean, last year, the bullpen was a guaranteed one or two home run outing, and this year, it wasn't that. And so I can't say I'm pleased with how the season ended, but if you had told me after Texas gets absolutely blasted in Arlington that first weekend of the year that we're complaining about Texas blowing a chance to go to Omaha, I laugh in your face.
Yeah, and look, we'll talk about the SEC football schedule, but Texas will be moving to the SEC in baseball in 2024 as well. And there's, you know, three SEC teams still alive in the College World Series. It may be more of a gauntlet in baseball than it even is in football. It's a good conference, and Texas needs to be ready to compete there. I think they're incredibly, you know, the young players they have are incredibly talented, and they're going to set themselves up well, I have no doubt. But, yeah, I mean, you mentioned the bullpen with injuries, right, with Luke Harrison going out, with losing, you know, two of your biggest innings eaters that were pitching the season just before the postseason, right? What they did in the last couple games of the year in that West Virginia series in particular with LeBaron Johnson and Lucas Gordon at the top, I mean, probably solidified both of them making All-American teams. What they did in you know, the regional in Miami, you know, certainly fantastic performance. You saw Stanford really, 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 really good bats. They're an imperfect team, but if you're just talking about a team that can hit the ball, they may be as good one through nine, as any team in the country. Like, they're very, very good bats. Really, it was their, you know, five through eight or six through nine that really tortured us all weekend. But once, you know, their big bats really got going, they're very, very good. And you saw a little bit of LeBaron Johnson and Lucas Gordon be a little bit less than, you know, All-American caliber, be a little bit less. But that was really a great hitting team. And again, for Gordon to come in, rectify some things, for Tanner Witt to get the chance and just not have it, you know, that was tough. But the kid could have just said, hey, I'm going to just go to the MLB. I'm done. But he wanted to play for Texas. And I give Pierce credit for running him out there and giving him a shot. If he had it, if it was his day, if he was electric, you know. But Morehouse, what a gutsy performance of six innings in relief to even keep us in that game. I mean, there's pitchers you have to talk about up and down, and I do think that Pierce and Woody Williams get some credit for sure for that. Like I said, incredible fight in game one to get there. Morehouse struck out the side, and that one looked phenomenal. Excited to see what he's got with him. Peyton Powell, a guy who looked good. Jared Thomas, Jalen Flores, guys who came on late in the end of the year. That's the core of the team next year, and I think they learn a lot from, you know, this run. You heard a couple clips where they talked about being a team that was in rebuilding. Like, they liked the idea that they were slept on this year, and it was a chip on their shoulder. May not be the case next year, right? They lose a lot, but they bring a lot back. They may be picked a little bit higher. Maybe they don't get to have that chip on their shoulder, but either way, I think the team is going to be in a good place to get back to where it belongs, which is Omaha.
We only dogpile in Omaha. So that win, that loss, unfortunately, clinched the Director's Cup win for Stanford. Texas would have had to beat Stanford and then go on to win a national championship for that. We'll actually have friend of the show, Texas Cup Dates, on, Brent Wilkerson, on next week to talk about just like this year in retrospective and just his thoughts and what Texas could have done. Texas did win the Capital One Cup, though, so suck on that, Trees. The second, the 20th. Top 10 finish for Texas in 30 years. And again, they slowly climbed and finally was able to knock off Stanford 2 years ago, won it back-to-back. But this year, it just wasn't in the cards. Lucas Gordon, for his efforts, was named the NCWBA, the All-American second team. And Dylan Campbell was named to the third team. Lucas Gordon and LeBaron Johnson were named to the Central All-Region first team, which also makes them eligible for ABCA All-American honors.
Yeah, Dylan Campbell and Porter Brown on that second team for the ABCA. So they getting some awards and some recognition. Again, I think it's hard to judge this Texas season with, if you just watch the West Virginia series, you say it's a team full of All-Americans in Miami. If you watched, you know, OU and Oklahoma State and Vanderbilt and some of those, you'd think there's no All-Americans. So an up-and-down year, I do think Dylan Campbell got a little bit robbed. I think he's going to be the type of guy who, when he has a nice 12-year pro career with a couple All-Star appearances in there, they're gonna feel badly about not rating him appropriately. A true five-tool guy, one of the best arms in college baseball, 38-game hitting streak, runs the bases hard, you know, hits for power, hits for average, dives for fly balls. He can do it all, and love that kid.
So now's the part of the show where we whip around all the rest of the stuff going on campus, and we down the 40. We start off in the future. It is the year 2024, and the University of Texas has a circular SEC patch on their shoulders. We now know who they'll be playing in conference. If you remember, there was a big debate about the 2024 season, whether or not the SEC would go to 9 games or 8 games for that season. Well, they stuck at 8 games for 2024, and here they are for the Longhorns in no particular order other than home and away. The first four are Texas at home, Mississippi State, Florida, Georgia, and Kentucky. Texas on the road, A&M, Arkansas, Vandy, and then OU is technically an away game, but that is a neutral site in the Cotton Bowl. Kyle, what jumps out to you about this schedule release?
I mean, it's a tough schedule, especially when you think they're playing at Michigan as one of their non-conference opponents. It seems they added University of Louisiana Monroe as their fourth non-con, so that gives them Colorado State, UTSA, and ULM as kind of three guaranteed wins. Their home schedule is pretty nice. I think it's a good combination of value for the season ticket holders. I just saw, I think they've sold 68,000 already, with 20,000 reserved for students. There's seats are going quick, folks. But Mississippi State, Florida, Georgia, Kentucky are all good, you know, good name brand teams. Florida and Georgia, obviously, national championship winning, and Georgia, you know, they're apex right now. Kentucky, I think it's a good SEC team to get at home. I think it should be them and Mississippi State, a team that'll punch you in the mouth a little, but Texas should have more firepower, and those should be wins. The road is really interesting to me because they only have three true road games, with their fourth being OU and the Cotton Bowl, which we know is there every year. So it's really at Aggie, at Arky, who obviously hate us with every fiber of their being, both of those, honestly, with the same fury and passion, which always blows my mind. People forget how much Arkansas hates Texas. And Vanderbilt, again, the two best destinations in the SEC are Nashville and Texas. So, you know, get a chance to go to Nashville right off the bat. Again, the way Vandy's program has trended, typically that's a guaranteed win. So it actually breaks a little bit favorably. I think I don't really care where we play Texas A&M. Playing Arkansas in their place is probably much, much harder than playing Arkansas at home, like significantly, because like I said, that is their biggest game of the year for Arkansas fans, for sure, as noted by their Twitter responses to this release. So, you know, I like it. It's a tough schedule. Texas needs to be up to the task, but I think they will be. There's a lot of wins on this schedule. There's you know, definitely some really tough ones, but I like it. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, the first thing I said was, man, those Arkansas fans and those Aggie fans are going to be tuned up for that game. But yeah, somebody asked, and I think like one of the big reasons why Texas wanted to go to the SEC was to enhance the home schedule, and like, talk about an upgrade. Like, no offense to the Big 12 folks that we know and love, but like, Florida and Georgia in DKR is a big stinking deal. And I think Texas got honestly a relatively favorable draw, right? All eyes go to Georgia, but like, Mississippi State is going to be okay. Florida, I don't know if Billy Napier can recruit a quarterback. We'll deal with that later. Georgia is going to be Georgia. Kentucky, going to be Kentucky, right? A&M and Arkansas are going to be tough ones on the road. But Vandy and OU, like, this is a solid schedule for Texas in its first year, and I'm not mad about it. I mean, and A&M got its way, right? Fine. Everybody's tired of hearing, like, everybody's tired of listening to you. Like, here, leave us alone. You get the home shut game. Up. Now shut up, right? Like, if Ross Bjork continues to complain about stuff, like, and the comparison of how Chris Del Conte handled this and saying basically, we'll play A&M anywhere on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, like, the way that he handled that is a perfect juxtaposition to what Ross Bjork has done throughout this whole thing. And I think the other, just the hilarious part is Chip Brown breaking this like 24 hours before. Like, how pissed is Sankey at him right now? It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, chip gonna chip. There are really great, fun Texas Twitter personalities and things that the SEC will get to have fun with. But our friend who's an Aggie was texting, you know, this means you have Luch back in your life and we have Chip back in our life. I mean, it's in catch to some extent, but you know, Chip gonna chip. He's gonna leak. That's what he's gonna do, whether it's true or not. He's gonna leak. I love that Feinbaum kind of the SEC, because they have their own. Feinbaum was the Chip of Alabama, and then became kind of the overlord of the entire conference. It's incredible. Feinbaum said this is, you know, one of the biggest moments in SEC history on his show, which I love that. Love them big upping it. They're clearly just they're pumping this big time. Tebow as well, you know, just gassing this up. Feinbaum did say, and I feel bad for OU. He said, "Yeah, everyone wants to play Texas," and that's how, you know, that's how they view it. And yeah, OU as well. They're a big brand. I will say my favorite thing about this, Gerald, is I saw Sark tweeted out, and then I saw multiple players on their Instagram and social media. There seemed to be a pretty on-brand message, I think, from every coach on the staff, every player on the roster. Don't look ahead. Don't get caught up in this. Don't start thinking about who's coming to DKR in 24. They all tweeted out the schedule for 2023, and I really like that. I like Sark with a man management strategy to do that, to really take this moment to recenter them on the goals at hand, earning, you know, the horns. And I don't know. I liked it. I like a lot of things Sark does from a people perspective, and I really liked where that seemed to come. It's the message that they need to have, right? Go win this year. Prove you're ready for win the Big 12 on your way out. Prove you're ready for the SEC. Make the playoff. Do all that this year, because that's your goals. That's what we're playing for. The other stuff, we'll see who's here. We'll see how it breaks down. It's a little bit of what Saban would call maybe rat poison to start thinking and dreaming and getting ahead. But I really love that. Probably my favorite thing about this whole exercise.
In the all of his OU got what Tim Tebow called a hug and a spank. People pay extra for that. Got home against Bama, Tennessee, South Carolina, and then a neutral against Texas at LSU, Auburn, Ole Miss, and Missouri. Sucks for them. Sucks to suck.
Yeah, the only getting three home games this first year because they're the home team in the Red River does suck. And when two of them are Bama and Tennessee, again, we got Georgia, but they got Bama and Tennessee and a South Carolina team that's, you know, you don't want, they're feisty.
Home, baby.
and then you turn around and have to go to LSU. Oof, glad we don't have that one year one. Auburn and Ole Miss, who, you know, you don't want to see either of those teams, especially if you're having a good season. They just love to throw wrenches in your, you know, like they're pissing the punch bowl teams. Like, just by and large, that is what they do. They piss in the punch bowl. Then a Mizzou team, you never know. You never know what Mizzou's going to do, and you got to go there. One of the biggest unknowns in the SEC. They've had a much better SEC performance than A&M inexplicably over the period since they've gone to the conference. Most years, you don't have to worry too much about them. But even this year, you know, Georgia was almost, I think, two quarters worth looked like they were going to, you know, find their blemish, and it was against Mizzou. So they're another. OU got a full list of landmines. So good luck to you, Sooners. Comrades in arms entering the new conference.
Speaking of comrades in arms, someone we love, Elliot Spezieri, was named the ITA National Player of the Year. Second Longhorn to win that one after Hess Olsen won it in 2015. Women's basketball to play in the U.S. Virgin Islands Paradise Jam Tournament next year. Nice to see that great little one. And then Christian Moss and Brian Stark both earning Big 12 postseason honors for their efforts this year.
Yeah, Christian Moss tabbed the newcomer of the year for the Big 12. Moss and Stark both named the All-Big 12 team. And Moss was named a Ping second team All-American. He's number 13 currently in the golf set rankings. I just saw this right before the show. I missed it live. They competed over the weekend in the Arnold Palmer Cup. It's the U.S. versus the world. Mixed teams of men and women. I think there's 12 total selected. Moss was one of the world. And Team USA was able to reclaim their title that the world had won last year, 32-28. There was one round, I think the third round, where Moss really stood out. Two eagles, four birdies to earn a 5-3 win over previously unbeaten Caleb Surratt in that third round. But, you know, the USA prevailed. So, you know, if Texas is, this is like an Olympics conversation we're coming back to. If Texas's international player wins, but the team loses, that's, you know, that's good for us, USA, USA. It's a big honor to both Stark and Moss, who again is a freshman. All right, Gerald, now let's take it to the part of the show. Look through the world through some burnt orange lenses. I'll start us off with a fun one. There was a tweet from the Hillsboro Hops Twitter account that showed a video of Ivan Melendez hitting a ball as far as a human being I've ever seen hit one. It was confirmed 470 plus. They said the wind was actually blowing in. So they were, you know, saying where it landed with the wind. They were going to go ahead and give it a 500 plus designation. Basically behind the field, which I love minor league baseball, behind the baseball field, there was a softball field. And he hit it not into the softball field, but well into like the third base of the softball field, which is the farthest base the way the field was positioned behind. Just crushing it, mashing it. I feel like we're going to see him as a Diamondback in short order.
He's on a track to, I think, end up in the majors in the show at some point. Like, kid is just mashing the ball, and he's picking right back up where he left off in Austin. It's fun to see.
Yeah, he's good at this baseball thing, man. Basketball. Let's switch up sports here a little bit. This is, I don't think any of this is an incredible surprise, but it did officially come out this week with kind of the titles and designations, and there's some folks moving around on the men's basketball side. The coaching staff for 2023, Frank Haith, who we on this podcast talked about his hiring a couple, I don't know, maybe a month or two ago. He was on the Penny Hardaway staff at Memphis, longtime Missouri head coach as well. He is an assistant coach. Steve McClain was elevated to an assistant coach, was on the staff but not as a coach. And then Chris Ogden, who I believe, I don't remember his role last year, director of basketball or something like that, was named as the general manager of the men's basketball team. The only coach staying in his current position is Brandon Chappelle, is his second season as assistant coach on that staff.
You know, I think Rodney Terry's putting together a really solid staff. You know, there was a rumor that LaMarcus might be in some sort of like assistant coach or associate coaching position. He may just, I want LaMarcus to be on like the Michael Huff tip where he's just like, I don't need money. I'm just going to be here and hang out and maybe wear Jordans and go sleeveless. Like if LaMarcus Aldridge was the Michael Huff of Texas basketball, I'd be very happy about it.
Yeah. We know LaMarcus is still living in Central Texas. So I think he was in San Antonio up until a few months ago, was at least holding residence there. So he's in Centex. I like the idea of just our studs going, playing pro ball, and then coming back and just laughing and having fun around the program. That stuff adds value without a doubt. Speaking of adding value, men's tennis, Elliot Spizzeri. We talked about his awards earlier in the show. He was selected for the 2023 USTA Collegiate Summer Team, which basically this is a program where they bring five of the best college players and give them some of the best coaching over the summer to try to help them transition. He hasn't announced that he's going pro, but typically people who go to the USTA Collegiate Summer Team go pro shortly thereafter. So we may be Spizzeri-less as we look to a lot of juniors on that team we talked about. Seek the vengeance of the number one team not getting the national championship, but we shall see. Hasn't been announced, but it is something to think about. And then also men's tennis, Brandon Wagner was recently named his assistant coach at Texas, named the head coach of Clemson men's tennis.
It's going to be sad to see Spizzeri go if he likely does, but you know, it's great to see those guys going on to do bigger and better things. So I think it's going to be great to see. And again, Texas has gotten multiple assistants hired from multiple programs in the last several years. And so this is what Texas should be now. Once the football team catches up, like Texas being the destination that gets you the big job where you want to go, whether it's as a player or as a coach, like that's the brand that we all think the University of Texas should have. And I'm glad to see it happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I believe Wagner this week was named the Texas Region Assistant Coach of the Year. So he was a hot target for many teams. He played at Georgia, so going back closer to home. On the women's tennis side, women's tennis signs another fantastically easy to pronounce name, which is a thing they do, and I appreciate them for that. We are talking, of course, Tanya Sasnuskaya. As a grad transfer, spent the previous 4 years at Old Dominion. This year was the number 25 in the final ITA singles ranking Sun Belt Player of the Year. A really great player, actually even more than singles, has been a double standout throughout her career.
Bolstering that women's team, she went to the round of 16 in the doubles realm as a junior, and she was an All-American as a doubles player. Like the Texas tennis program seems to be reloading. I think not finishing as a finalist or a national runner-up was something that I think they're taking personally, and they'll continue to get better. So glad to see it.
Yeah, and we said they you know they lacked a Peyton Stearns type top of the lineup closer. I think bringing the number 25 player has been as high as I think she finished her junior number 7 in doubles certainly is a top of the line type addition. We'll see where she ends up, but definitely a lot of talent there. Speaking of programs that just reload, rowing, again, we said the gaggle of geese withstanding is as good a program as we have on campus right now. Four Longhorns from that program invited to the U.S. Rowing Senior National Team, the big national team selection camp for the 2023 World in September. That's Emily Froelich, Kate Nifton, Daisy Mazio Manson, and Coxon for the past 3 years, Rachel Rain, among 40 selected across all the boats. So they'll trim that down a bit, but hopefully all four of them make it to the final USA team for 2023 Worlds.
Watch out for geese.
Gerald, a little bit of Godzillatron. Take us to the ending here. What have you been watching on your giant screen?
So actually, I did some watching on a tiny screen this week. I did some flying for work. I was in Indianapolis for work earlier this week, part of our scheduling issues. And so I got to catch up on a movie I missed, and then I rewatched a movie I really love. John Wick 4, I watched it in its intended setting, a 13-inch screen on the back of an airplane screen. It was one of those, it's been a weird year for my wife and I. We haven't been able to go see movies, and John Wick's not really her cup of tea. Anyways, I simultaneously love and hate the John Wick franchise. I love the action sequences, and I just wish we didn't have to deal with a lot of the like weird world building they do. Like, I don't want to keep up with all of the like the Marquis and the weird Russian girl that was Tonks and Harry Potter, and like just not, like. The choreography is great and the story's fun, and like obviously a 55-year-old Keanu Reeves doing action is always fun, but like I miss when it was just Keanu Reeves getting revenge because they killed his dog, right? Like that, like the story was so simple. It was a relatively simple story. I love a good revenge tale. But again, I will be there when they somehow do John Wick 5 in a couple of years, even though John Wick 4 ended how it did. And then I rewatched, and this is probably not a great plane watch, but whatever, I did it anyways. I'm sorry to the people around me. I rewatched Get Out because I hadn't had a chance to watch it in a few years. And like, I forgot how perfect I felt that movie was from like just an execution standpoint. The way they did it, the message they were, you know, what Jordan Peele was really trying to say about a lot of things, and just like everything about that movie is just incredible. And Jordan Peele almost, it's one of those like, and I'm not saying that Us or Nope are bad movies, but like when you come out the gates with Get Out, it's really hard to live up to that standard. But it's just so, so good. So yeah, that's what I watched. And it's been, it's a pretty solid week of streaming.
Gerald, are you always a plane guy? Do you have a mix, a ratio of podcast, audiobook to movie, you know, on your airplane flights, do you break it down or you always go movie?
It's really just a vibe. Like I try to have it already. Like I have some TV stuff downloaded on my phone. Mm. Obviously I fly Delta. That's what I fly for work. So like they have the screens in the back of the chairs. So like I was really tired and it seemed like the least amount of effort just to plug in some headphones to the screen and lean my head back. That's how we ended up there this week.
No, I respect that. You've had a lot going on. So Gerald, I filled a hole in my, like, you know, sometimes you have those shows and those movies that you, like, for years, you know, I need to watch, and it's silly that I don't, and everyone that I know and respect their opinion says you're going to like it. It's one of those things, and when I say I didn't watch any of the NBA Finals, but I definitely saw Heat, you know exactly that I'm talking about the Michael Mann movie that somehow had escaped me, and it felt like I already was like, people like, what are your favorite movies? I was like, well, it's gonna be Heat, and you know, like I hadn't seen it, but I knew that I was gonna love it. It just recently came on Netflix. For a while it was not streaming, so like I'm pretty anti paying to watch something in the age of having like five different streaming services. So I've been actually wanting to watch Heat since like the pandemic. I remember I searched for it one time and it just hasn't streamed anywhere. So it just recently came on Netflix, and man, it's long. It's like 3 hours, but it's so freaking good, and it seems to be the template for like modern action movies. I don't know that many get the psychological piece of it, and obviously you don't always get a Pacino, De Niro still in their prime against each other, right? Like even Godfather, they
it's
were
the first
kind
time
of, yeah, again, like not on the screen at the same time in the same movie, but in their prime, the first time, mano a mano, the kind of psychological matching of your equal both as actors and as the characters, and then just really, really great action stuff. I mean, it to me is as good an action movie as I've ever seen. While I love all the Fast and Furious, and there's just like, I love the big over the top explosion and the I'll kill you with a pencil of Keanu Reeves, there's just something so classic. And so like, when I watched it, I immediately thought about like 20 other things, like, oh, they totally copped this, or oh, they were playing on this. Like, I didn't realize how influential, I'm not calling it like Star Wars set motifs for a genre, but it's probably not terribly far from that for what they did for the action movie world. It was real, real, real good.
Of like Michael Mann was on a real heater from like 92 to like 04. Like the run of Last of the Mohicans, Heat, Insider, Ali, Collateral. Like, name, that's a really solid run of five straight. And then he made Miami Vice and Public Enemies, and that was a whole other conversation for another day. But, like, Heat is an all-timer for me, for sure.
Yeah. The other thing I watched, actually, Gerald, was an ESPN documentary, and I didn't talk to him about it when I had dinner with him, but I think I mentioned to everyone I had dinner with Wright Thompson a couple weeks ago when I was in Mississippi for his new book, Pappy Land. I didn't, but I had seen it on his social media or just heard about it. He did a Outside the Lines piece about the Ukraine soccer team, basically in the midst of the war, how they handled it, really focused on their coach who had the task of trying to keep a team focused on soccer. And when sports was the least, you know, important thing in the world, it's almost like, you know, Bush throwing out the first pitch in New York after 9/11. Like, sports can have that healing and restorative moment. And what a, like, great drama it was. And then it's kind of, I won't ruin everything, but it builds up to, it also happened to be that they had basically a two-game playoff and what boiled down to a one-game playoff, really the first ever of win and get into the World Cup. And so just built-in drama. He's in war-torn Kiev, you know, with the various players. Like, just I cried. Like, it was a really harrowing, like, documentary, especially because you remember that's still going on. Like, we're still in the thick of it. But I thought it's called Remember the Blue and Yellow. I thought it was as good, and that's why I like Wright Thompson, right? His sports things are rarely about sports and merely use sports as the vehicle to tell the larger story. But it was so good, like so good. One of my favorite things, 30 for 30s included, that ESPN has put out in you know, years. So I would recommend both Heat, but certainly if you only watch one of them, Remember the Blue and Yellow, a fantastic hour. If that's 4 hours total and three of them are Heat and you only have one to spend, definitely watch the documentary. It was moving, powerful, well-made, great story, just an incredible piece.
I'll have to check it out. I love a good I love a good 30 for 30. I love a good Outside the Lines report, so I definitely have to check it out. Now we're part of the show where we honor one of the best traditions in all of college athletics, Big Bertha, and we bang the drum, brought to you by Joe Ruiz. So, Kyle, what are you banging the drum on this week?
Any chance that I get, I try to brag on one of my favorite Longhorns, you know, of recent memory. You know, we big up Julian Alfred, and rightfully so, for her national championship performance. But it was also National Champions Day at the White House for teams that had already won. And I don't think track had won, or if they did, they had just won. So they didn't get a chance to join there. But teams from across college sports, from, you know, D1 all the way down at various levels, showed up for a White House Day of Champions, basically. And one of the speakers who was brought up to the podium during that was Logan Eggleston. And I love Logan Eggleston. I think she is everything about student and athlete excelling in both. She's everything about what starts here changes the world. Like, she was, you know, integral as the president of the Students Association on campus during kind of the Black Lives Matter and George Floyd, you know, time of incredible upheaval, and, you know, gave the athletes a seat at the table and a voice. And I just thought did an incredible job there. Obviously is one of the greatest college volleyball players I've ever seen of all time, to come through the University of Texas, All American, closed out her career with that Cinderella, absolutely dominated from start to finish, but that storybook, I should say, run to the national championship. And then she was asked to speak. There's pictures of her, you know, yucking it up with Kamala Harris, and she looked just as comfortable there as she does, you know, being set, ready to crush one down on someone's face. She just seems so natural in everything that she does, both on the court and off. And she's a person, and she gave a fantastic speech. I think it's on the Texas Volleyball Twitter. You can check it out there. But gave just a fantastic, nice speech. Just seemed so poised for, you know, you forget these people are 22 years old, and that's an incredible deal to be standing in front of the president and vice president at the White House and asked to give a speech, but gave a great speech. And it just was a reminder that, you know, we really marvel at the athlete portion of our student athletes, and we have some really incredible ones. Even a second place in the Director's Cup tells you there's hundreds and hundreds of unbelievable champions, athletes, you know, pro caliber people just honing their craft. But we have some really, really incredible students who really embody that. as well. And whatever she goes on to do with her career afterwards, I know she'll be a great success. And she's one of those people I will keep very close tabs on and root for at every phase of her career, even if volleyball isn't a part of that equation.
It's going to be weird, like completely weird, watching Texas volleyball without Logan Eggleston. Thankfully, Asia O'Neill will be there and some other familiar faces to smooth that over. We'll have our security blankets moving forward. I'm banging the drum this week on Texas making money for, again, what feels like the millionth year in a row. Texas tops the Big 12 in annual revenue with $239 million, second in the nation, just behind Ohio State. Granted, Ohio State has 13 more sports than the University of Texas. And there's a reason why Texas gets the favor that it does in a lot of ways, because Texas makes money, right? There's a reason why the SEC wanted Texas and Oklahoma, because Texas and Oklahoma were the top two teams in the Big 12, and it wasn't really that close, right? The gap between Texas and Oklahoma was quite sizable, about $60 million or so, and then the gap between Oklahoma and Kansas, the next one, was about $60 million. So there's a reason why Texas and OU are the two that the SEC sniped, and there's a reason why Texas gets things like really favorable home schedule, not favorable home schedule, but marquee home scheduling. Like, Texas got Georgia and Florida to put in DKR in their first year in the SEC. Meanwhile, A&M has only played them once and it was on the road, right? Played Georgia once and it was on the road. So, like, there is a reason why Texas is Texas. And, you know, even in a year where football was average, right, but the rest of the teams were really, really good and Texas made a ton of money, imagine what this number would be and potentially will be when the football team finally gets on the up and up, right? The SEC is just going to bolster that. And if Texas can be competitive in the SEC, like, Texas will continue to be an incredibly profitable brand and be desirable, and Texas will continue to be Texas.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, there's not another Big 12 team, even with the new teams coming in the top 35. There's a pretty clear gap between the broke boys. OU was number 10, good on them, and Texas. And you hear Nick Saban talk about how much money Aggies and UT and Ohio State are spending, and he's not wrong, right? They all had operating budgets, close to $200 million. The Aggies spent a lot. I think they were seventh in revenue, still high. OU basically is like a really good SEC team in terms of revenue. Texas and Ohio State are just on another level. But Gerald said it, right? Texas with 20 sports just blows Ohio State out of the water in revenue generated per sport. There is a reason you go to SEC. There is a reason that, you know, Tebow's on the SEC network saying Texas is a global brand. There's a reason. You know, I think had someone text me, they were in Europe somewhere, or they were watching a tennis match and the guy at center court is wearing a Longhorn hat. You know, it's like we pop up everywhere. It is a known brand. It is a thing. You can go almost anywhere in the world and people know the horns up sign. People know the Longhorn logo. It is just unique in the college landscape, and the SEC ain't gonna do nothing but expand that and make that stronger. And so for Ross Bjork and the new money Aggs, who you know, you could just tell how uncomfortable they are that daddy's coming home, and they don't get to act like the big tough Texan at the table anymore. They take a step back. You can see the petulance that comes when the Aggies have so much money, they ain't got Longhorn money.
As my dad once told me when I was a young man, nobody that's actually the man has to tell you they're the man. And that's all we've got for you this week. Kyle, where can the good folks find you on the internet?
Oh, you can follow me on Twitter at Kyle Carbon. You can also follow the Texas Pregamer at Texas Pregamer.
Follow me on Twitter. I am at GH Goodrich. Follow the show on Twitter at Longhorn Pod. Facebook and Instagram, The Longhorn Republic. Or shoot us an email, longhornrepublicpod@gmail.com. So I know we said last week we'd be back to two shows this week, but weird scheduling stuff happened. So we'll have two shows for you next week. We'll have Jeremy from the Tortillas and Takes podcast, as well as our friend Brett of the Director's Cup dates on Tuesday to give us a preview of Texas Tech and a recap of the Director's Cup year that was. And then on Thursday, we'll be back with another season preview and a preview of the big recruiting weekend with our friend Huddy Buddy from 247 Sports. Thank you so much for tuning in again this week. And until next time, hook 'em.
Hook 'em. Saw down the trees.